LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
In order to walk among us, they disguised their appearance by cloning human flesh over their own reptilian skin. But the visitors didn't just get here. They've been here for years. For decades, they've been implementing a plan that will result in the extermination of every man, woman, and child on the face of this earth. These posing as humans established themselves in all facets of life, whether it be business, government, religion, the military. It took years. And what's embedded among us, they set out to cause worldwide instability, unnecessary wars, economic meltdown, faith twisted into extremism. The final stage of the visitors' plan began with them revealing themselves to us. They gained trust with the promise of friendship and technology, and of course all they're really doing is positioning themselves as the saviors of mankind.
I went through an extraordinary series of what you might call paranormal experiences, not that they were, 20 years ago in 1989, and basically the veil lifted, and I saw the world in a completely different way, and I started on a journey of research, which has led me over 20 years to a very obvious conclusion. That this world is controlled by very, very few people behind the people we think are in power, and they have a very, very malevolent agenda for humanity as a whole, who to them are nothing more than cattle. This family bloodline interbreeding control system of these elite families was not just a human thing. It went beyond that into entities that are anything but human.
The visitors arrived in 50 gigantic motherships, which stunned the world with their monumental size and power.
We have come in peace
because we need your help. And in return, we will gladly share with you all the fruits of our knowledge.
Talk about an offer we can't refuse, huh?
In the weeks that followed, the visitors became a new and friendly part of our lives. The visitors were quickly assimilated into our culture. Many close relationships developed between our people and theirs. But there were some who were skeptical, too inquisitive. They began to quickly disappear. And then...
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Scott Alan Roberts, who joins us to discuss his book, The Secret History of the Reptilians, The Pervasive Presence of the Serpent in Human History, Religion, and Alien Mythos. The very real probability that non-human intelligences visited and even copulated with primordial humans is detailed in civilization's most ancient cultural and religious records. These historical records further reveal that these intelligences were reptilian in nature, or at the very least, have been represented throughout human history in reptilian form. From the serpent Nakash in the Garden of Eden, Atum, the Egyptian snake man, and Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent god of the Mayans, to the double helix snake symbol of Enki in ancient Sumerian literature, the serpent has been the omnipresent link between humans and the gods in every culture. Did a race of reptilians come to this planet long ago? Did extraterrestrials seed the human race or genetically engineer primordial hominids, creating a slave race? Were humans freed from bondage, led by a traitor from within the ranks of the alien oppressors? Is there an extraterrestrial race that has shifted in and out of human affairs for all of recorded history, governing our destiny from the shadows? Or are we bound by religious thought and man-made myth, only to suffer in its invisible grasp until we move beyond the need for false gods, devils, and monsters that subjugate us to our own fears? Hello and welcome, Scott, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Well, thanks for having me. I sure appreciate it.
Scott, today we're going to talk about your book, which is entitled The Secret History of the Reptilians. Subtitle is The Pervasive Presence of the Serpent in Human History, Religion, and Alien Mythos. Before we dive into that, just tell listeners a little bit about your personal background and how you got interested in our reptilian past.
Sure. Well, first let me say, if your listeners hear all kinds of ambient noises, children worshiping at my feet, and noises from out here, I am broadcasting from my home with a big open air door on the garage. So there we go. Well, what got me into this? Reptilians, The Secret History of the Reptilians, was actually a follow-up book that came out in February, I think it was, of 2013, so a year ago, almost a year and a half ago now. And it was a follow-up to my first book with New Page Books, which was The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim. And it was a follow-up in that it really segued off of the theories of the serpent in the garden, the Nephilim, and all of those topics. And so that's where the book itself came from. And it started as an examination of the whole alien mythos behind the reptilians, and swiftly as I was writing it, I found it turned into more an examination of the mythology. And by mythology, I want to make it very clear that I'm not saying that I don't think there's something to some of the theories out there. I'm open to the possibilities, but I label it as I do with, say, biblical stories, that they are part of the, if you will, the Hebrew or Jewish religious mythology. And so it's not saying it doesn't exist. It's saying this is how you have to handle it. If you step outside the box and try to look at it, rather than just be completely immersed in one point of view about them, then it starts to become something that from the outside looks like, oh, he's just writing from the perspective of he believes in ancient aliens or something like that. And so you try to extricate yourself from that when you write these so you can be somewhat... somewhat pure, I guess, in presenting information, but I also did an awful lot of opining in that book as well. So tying into religious past and things like that. So that's where this particular book got its birth, was in the midst of enjoying the success of The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim, and then sitting back in my chair, staring at the ceiling, spinning in my ergonomically correct chair, and wondering, okay, just who is God anyway? Because all of this stuff starts to look very different than what I was taught in seminary and back in Bible college and church and so on. So there you go.
Yeah, no, you just referred to your personal past. This is something that's puts a really interesting wrinkle in all of this for me anyway. So tell folks a little bit about that, you know, your religious
sure.
history. Because, you know, because it's, I wouldn't say it's not relevant to this, but it gives you a perspective that not many of us have.
Sure. Well, I'll tell you this. When I was a child, I'd say just preteen, I became a born again Christian into the Baptist Church, a very fundamental conservative Baptist church up here. Now that's a good 42 years ago, and that's where I got my start. I was very deep into the youth group and the church. My family wasn't, but I was. I was kind of, if this reference makes any sense to you, if you remember the show Family Ties from the 80s on television, American sitcom, I was the Alex Keaton of my house. I was the white shirt, tie wearing, religious, conservative, Reagan economics kid in a family of very liberal Democrats. And I remember my mother saying once when I was a teenager, I wish you would just swear once in a while so I'd know you were normal. And so that's the kind of kid I was. I got very steeped in theology and in the church. And I went off to Bible college and then went on to seminary after that and worked toward, but didn't finish seminary. I worked toward my Master of Divinity. And I was in youth ministry for a number of years, but it was those post-seminary years where I really started to question some things. It's kind of like, you know, there's the whole Pauline epistle, the verse that says, you know, when you're a child, you you suckle on milk, but when you're an adult, you need meat. And to me, it all started to become milk, the stuff that we were being presented in church. It was the pre-chewed pablum, you know, that was fed to babies. And I thought, what is there's deeper issues here, because there's linguistic things I have questions about. There's stories I have questions about that we explain away. Just for a quick example with the Nephilim itself. It's in Genesis 6, and it says, "And in those days the sons of God came down and intermingled with the daughters of men and had children by them. And the Nephilim were on the earth in those days." Now, that's a hinge pin verse for a lot of people who are also into ancient alienist theory, saying, were these aliens, were they gods, were they angels, or were they extraterrestrials? What were they? And I remember when we parsed that down into the languages in which they were written, the Hebrew for the sons of God was the Bnei HaElohim. The sons of the Elohim, or those of the Elohim, came down and intermingled with the daughters of Adam in the Hebrew. And there was a stark contrast. And I said, what are these beings? And I was told, well, that's nothing more than just the sons of the aristocrats who built the school of the prophets, and they went down the hill and into the valley, in a sense, slumming with the common women and had offspring. I said, really? That's your explanation theologically? I said, didn't you teach us that language means something? I don't know how many times, if I had a dime every time I heard in church, now look at what the original Greek says or the original Hebrew says, I'd already be retired and living in a small island in the Caribbean. I looked at that and I said, the original language has a contrast. Those of the Elohim versus those of Adam. And I said, how do you explain that? And they couldn't explain that. I was basically told, don't make trouble. And so I grew up into my 20s starting questioning a lot of these things. And it actually put a rift between me and my faith. And I said, now that I'm an adult and I'm thinking about these things, I'm looking more scientifically, and I'm looking into comparative religions, I'm starting to doubt. So I would say I've become, now in my early 50s, I've become a guy who is probably thoroughly agnostic. But like a good friend of mine from over in your neck of the woods, basically, he's over in Glastonbury, Timothy Freak. He told me, he says, you know, Scotty, he says, agnosticism leads to gnosis. So the lack of knowledge or the doubts are the things that lead to more knowledge and gaining of it. And I think that's what's happened a bit over the years. I don't want to go so far as to say I've gained any wisdom out of it, but I've certainly acquired some knowledge on these things. And that's really the path over the last 30 to 40 years that's led me to where I am now.
There's a lot written on the reptilian theories, that whole area. I mean, there's stuff published constantly, and long history of it as well. I appreciated the approach that you took with your book, because there's a lot of hysteria. There's a lot of hype, and there's a lot of, you know, wild theories. And I like the objectivity that your book has on it.
Thank you. You know, that's something that bothered me too, as I started looking into the founding of Judaism, the founding of Islam, the founding of the major religions. It looked like this, and I'm not trying to be too cheeky with this, but think of it this way. If we look at Moses said he had an experience meeting God face to face at the burning bush, but nobody else was there with him. But he founded a whole religion on that. So I found that religious movements or cultic movements or whatever they might be seem to be founded by people who say, I've had this experience. I think we're being dive-bombed by World War II fighter jets here.
That sounds a bit like a Stuka, doesn't it?
I live in a little town, and we had at the local airport a big World War II airbirds show. So they're all buzzing overhead. That's some of my ambient noise, by the way. So I wanted to look at this in a way that says, it seems to me that most big religious-type movements start with a guy. A guy who's had a religious experience, an epiphany, and he's the only guy that's experienced it. And he spreads it to somebody else who believes him, or somebody close to him who trusts him, finds him credible, or knows him to be credible beyond that experience. And what happens? It spreads into a fervor. Not in every case, but when you see, like, I use Moses as an example. He said, this happened to me. And then he goes, and at least according to the Old Testament scripture, he goes and he leads the people out of Israel and establishes a nation And that nation is based on the fact that for the first half of his life to that point, he was thoroughly Egyptian. He may have been Hebrew or Israelite by birth, but he was Egyptian. And he brought with him Egyptian religion, Egyptian spirituality, Egyptian architecture. He brought with him, for the 40 years in between, he brought with him the Sinaitic religions, the Mesopotamian religions, the Sumerian culture, if you will, and also down south, the Sudanese, Kush, those places. He brought all of that stuff with him, and he created, I believe, Judaism out of whole cloth. And so this is what you've got with the reptilians, I believe, is somebody had an experience, or bunches of people had different experiences, and they all form this into a collective, and it becomes a belief system. I believe that there are reptilians here on this earth, or that reptilians founded us, or that reptilians came here and created primeval man, because it also ties into some of the old mythologies and the old religious mythologies. There's serpents, snakes, always present in all these theologies. And so there's common threads and common ties that seems to have created a collective mythos about reptilians.
Yeah, well, of course, this has persisted for so long because of it's so common. I mean, the reptilian archetype or idea in myth and culture is pervasive. I mean, it's been everywhere forever, so it seems. So I've often found myself saying, well, therefore, there must be something to this. But I've also tried to objectively contemplate the question, is it possible that all of this, I mean, 100% of it is just our imagination? And
yes.
Of course, you know, we don't have those answers, but the speculation has a story in itself.
I'm right there with you. I say I even state in the book, there's got to be something to this. Just what that is, we don't know. If we want to go all the way over into the skeptical or the scientific mode on this, we would say it doesn't seem to fit a scientific plausibility. We say, maybe in the back of our heads, we say it's possible, but there's no way to quantify or qualify that. And so we tend to at least scientifically brush it off. Skeptically, we brush off everything. And let me just make a note here, too. I believe there's two different kinds of skeptics out there. I believe there's the capital S skeptic and the small s skeptic. The capital S, or the big S skeptic, is the one who is basically the Michael Shermer types, the amazing Randy for what he's relevant for anymore anyway. All of those types. They're the ones that are there. I find them to be just denialists of anything outside the realm of scientific thought. They're your big skeptics, you know, the ones that will say extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. I agree with that to a point, but I'm a small s skeptic, which is the other kind, which means I adhere to a certain form of skepticism that says I need to see it. I need to have it proven. I need to see the facts, but I can't dismiss something just because it doesn't fit into my mode of thinking or my mode of science or my mode of skepticism. If I'm an atheist, I might just deny it because I believe there's nothing else out there. That's a bias in and of itself. So I like to look at all this and say, if you're a big-ass skeptic, you're going to deny anything exists other than what can be quantified by science, by current science. Just remember, you know, 8,000 years ago, we couldn't, with current science of the day, quantify oxygen. So does that mean we didn't have any? No, it just meant that we couldn't parse it down into chemical compounds. We couldn't define it by current science of the day, but it did exist. Same thing with some of this. If we can extrapolate that same kind of thinking into the reptilians, there might be something to that. Probably is something to it. There's probably something to the whole extraterrestrial question, the whole ancient alien question. I don't for a minute dismiss that. But I say if we try to work with what is, you sometimes have to discard what might be, you know, the folly of trying to believe something that has absolutely no evidence to it at all. That's the problem we face. And of course, people will argue with me right away on that point and say, well, there's all kinds of evidence saying that there have been alien visitations here. Well, no, there's not. There's things we have speculated must be alien in nature. I just read an article this morning about the, what are they calling them? The OOP facts or something like that. They're kind of offhanded archaeological finds. Artifacts that have been found, human-made artifacts, axes, wooden handles, little clay sculptures and things like that found buried in coal beds that are supposed that have been dated to, you know, 200 million years ago. Does that mean that mankind existed more than 200 million years ago and was making tools out of processed iron? What does that mean exactly? And that's the big... So those are some of the big questions it faces. Is our dating system wrong? Is is carbon dating... we know carbon dating is not always quite as reliable as it could be. But after tons of testing, this, that, and the other thing, thousands of artifacts that have been found in these stratas... what do you come up with? You come up with an overall thread that says these things are buried in stone that's 400 million years old. What does that mean? How did it get there? We don't know how it got there. We don't know how it was formed. We don't know exactly what happened. We just have basic scientific facts. So does that lead to a conclusion that there was a civilization here 400 million years ago of advanced humans? Does that say that there were aliens? It doesn't. That's the problem. It says there's something going on where there's plausibility for a different explanation than what we already have. The problem is we can't focus on it. We can't find it. We can't pinpoint it. And that's the theory, the train of thought that I brought into this book on the reptilians, is that there's a lot of things that look like this. There's a lot of proponents of this. There's lots of stories out there. But are those stories evidence, or are they somebody's speculation? For instance, in the book, I even did it as I was writing the book. I stopped. And I said, I'm going to go do a Google search right now. And I did a Google search of alien reptilians. I ended up with 1.6 million references on the internet to alien reptilians. Out of the top 10 that just showed up in the Google, every single one of them, all different websites, none of them related to each other, all gave the same story. It looked like they all plagiarized each other or plagiarized an original source. But not a single one of them cited a source. But you had that same story proliferating everywhere. And I said, now this is the problem we're facing. We got stories proliferated with no source points. How do we know? And if we want to know things, we got to look for answers. And we got to know something before we put it out there as I believe there were alien reptilians. Well, we don't know that. Some things may point to that, may look like it, but there's no way to quantify it or qualify it.
Well, I think that capital S skepticism and what other people have called scientism are sort of in some ways the new religion, and they're almost as unhelpful as a religious point of view when trying to sort of analyze these things. And it's interesting, actually, that you mentioned atheists before who will deny anything beyond the... that anything non-material and non-local can exist, they would sort of dismiss questions about the reptilian aspect to sort of human history just as, vociferously as religious people would. They both deny that there was possibly anything to this.
And the problem with the religious argument, even the religion I grew up in and spent most of the first half of my life in, the problem with that is that all the answers to these things are from within that faith. It's very hard to quantify or qualify a faith from arguments garnered within the faith. What you have to do, I had an old seminary professor of mine who really liked my book on the Nephilim. He says, but Scotty, he says, he talked like that. He's kind of a little egg-headed professor, very dear friend and somebody I really admire, mentor of mine. But he said, Scotty, oh my, he says, you've got to make sure you're using the Bible as your filter. And I said, but Doc, I said, if I use the Bible as my filter, I said, I'm preaching almost literally. I'm speaking apologetically from within that religion. I said, wouldn't it make better sense if I could step outside the box of a biblical filter and look at these things and talk about them from that respect? I said, wouldn't that give us a better perspective? And that's my take on things. And that's the approach I took in this book.
It's you mentioned the ancient aliens thing earlier. And it's to me, it's always been fascinating about how this, what in some ways would seem like a really fringe idea. Anyway, the idea of sort of there being a reptilian aspect, there could be some reality to this in our distant past. Just how mainstream it is. I mean, look how popular Ancient Aliens, the TV series. I mean, how many seasons have they done now?
I think they're on their sixth season. I was in four episodes of season five, I think. It was filmed at our Paradigm Symposium, October of 2012, and it didn't air until early October of 2013. So it was almost a year later before the interviews they did with me. And they interviewed me for about an hour and a half, asked me 40, 50 questions. And I was up and down because I run this event. But they aired it in four or five different episodes is what I was told. I've seen one of them where I held a whole 9-second piece in the whole episode. And I thought, wow, I've made it now, baby. I'm on Ancient Aliens for 9 seconds. But apparently they did more in other episodes. The point being with that is they asked me a lot of questions. I didn't see how they edited things in some of the other episodes, but I've talked to people that write for our magazine, Intrepid Mag, and are speakers at our symposium, like Robert Bavall, Dr. Robert Schock, who else? Some of these guys I've talked to, and they said they'll never do Ancient Aliens interviews again because they're so edited. They edit up what they say. They don't change their words around. They just don't give the full statement, and it makes it sound like they're saying something completely different. I think Ancient Aliens, keep in mind that show, as much as I like the producers of that show, and I like Prometheus Productions, and I've got good friends there, and I've made good friends there, I think we forget that they're also a television show that has production standards that they have to meet. And those production standards are, find something else that's alien related, and where can you extrapolate alien theory into this? The episode on Einstein was an alien or something like that just kind of threw me. So, you know, there's good theories and good things in the mix, but what we have to be careful of is how much of that stuff we listen to and take on board without doing our own research. This is the thing about biblical studies, about religious studies of any kind, anthropology, archaeology. If you listen to one source point or one train of thought, that's all you're going to get. John Ward, Dr. John Ward, he's my partner in all these efforts, and he's also my co-author on our most recent book, which was The Exodus Reality. And we presented two theories on who the historical Moses was, who we thought he was, our two different theories. The problem we faced when doing that, we used the same mode of approach of being open-minded, open, outside the box, looking at what evidence is available, coming to conclusions, and we differ with each other in our conclusions only by about 80 years and two generations in the 18th dynasty. But the point being with this is that we got all kinds of criticism from people who were very steadfastly entrenched in one mode of thought about it, either from the Bible is a bunch of garbage, there's no real efficacious history there, versus those who would say, oh, no, it was definitely Ramses II was the Pharaoh of the Exodus, which is a bunch of garbage, if you ask me, if you're worth your salt historically at all. And that's the approach you have to take with all of this stuff. Reptilians, ancient aliens, biblical topics, scriptural, spiritual topics. You need to approach these things and look at it. Is there more information than just my faith or my train of thought offers? And it's hard to do for people. That's why there is so much argument in these fields. And so many people go, oh, that so-and-so character is simply an ass because he doesn't use the same, you know, criteria that I use. And the problem with all of that is that if you get stuck in one train of thought, you've closed yourself to any other information.
With regard to Ancient Aliens, the TV series, and the comments you made, it's a bit like conspiracy theory springs to mind, the TV series with Jesse Ventura.
Yes.
And he ultimately says, you know, this is entertainment.
Yeah, he does. But he's also, I liked Jesse. I lived in the state of Minnesota when he was the governor of Minnesota. And he went from wrestling Jesse the Bod to Jesse the Gov. And one thing I liked about Jesse was he told things the way he saw it, and he didn't care what anybody thought about his opinion. He said, this is my opinion, and I don't give a damn if you don't like my opinion. That's the way he approached his show. Just a brief example, I remember when he was running for governor, he was up in one of the small towns in the northern part of Minnesota, and all kinds of hundreds of people gathered around him. He's walking down the street, and he's campaigning. Somebody's heckling him from the sidelines, and he yells out, and this was on camera. They showed it on the news, and it was kind of a funny bit. He yells back to the heckler. He says, oh, yeah, dumbass. He says, well, I don't need your vote. And so that's the kind of person he was and is, and that's how he approached his television show. And so that's something that that he, I think, did a very good job at with conspiracy theory.
Oh, Jesse Ventura and the best movie ever made, Predator.
Oh, yeah. I ain't got time to bleed.
Et cetera, et cetera. Very quotable, isn't it?
Et cetera,
it?
Yes.
But with regard to the whole reptilian premise in itself, it's strange how it seems to resonate with so many people when they are first introduced to it. Thinking about the reptilian, the overlap perhaps with the ancient alien idea, I remember finding, just because they looked interesting, stumbling upon Eric von Daniken's books back in the early to mid-80s when I was quite young.
And which then they were already almost 20 years old.
Yeah, exactly. They were sort of, you know, they'd already been extensively debunked. But when I read them, it was like so many, it was a real page turners. And at so many points reading those, I was like, yes, there must be something to this. Now, why, when that was all completely new to me, this concept, why did it keep me up at night reading these things, just thinking that I've stumbled upon something important? What was that about?
You know, I think it's because we all start at that spot when we're young, when we're kids, and this stuff tickles our curiosities because we all want to know what's out there. Is it what I'm taught in church? Is it out of a book? Is it something like that? Is that the truth of the matter? Is there something more? I open up my book on the Nephilim in the introduction. I say I spent far too many hours laying on the roof of the garage of my mother's house, staring into the stars, wondering where we came from. And so there's all those questions that we had as kids, they spark curiosity. And the question is, from a religious standpoint or a faith standpoint, they tell you that's God speaking to you and he's calling you to himself. And that's that curiosity, that God-shaped vacuum in our hearts that we all have that we need to fill with only God, but we try to fill with everything else. That's the religious point of view. And the other point of view, I've heard it said, there is a consciousness, a common consciousness in human beings. There is that void, that gap that lies within our consciousness somewhere that's been either erased, somehow eradicated, removed, or covered up. And is there a coded message there that we need to follow? I looked even when I was doing my studies in the Genesis story of creation for both of these books. I find that it's a greater story that seems to be an encoded message. It's like if you start digging deeper, you're going to find more information right there in the scriptural part. You're going to find that there is actually encoded information there that means something far greater than the cover story, if you will.
It's also interesting to contemplate. I mean, you address in the book, unlike the rest of life on this planet, we seem to have this, as human beings, this innate need to know about our origins and purpose. And if we look at some of the reptilian ideas, theories, concepts, you know, if we were genetically manipulated or perhaps created as a slave race, perhaps that hole in our hearts is to do with, you know, is it possible that our existence is pointless now? I mean, a lot of people take a sort of nihilistic view of existence, don't they?
You know, that's kind of the viewpoint I take on it, too. I think I said, I don't know which book I wrote it in, but I said something like, well, it's either one of two things. We are all God's children, and we are all really fallen away from God, and God has control of us. We are all sinful in nature. We all face an eternity in hell unless we accept God on his terms and so on. It's either all of that, or it's that opposite. We're controlled by some alien race that created us, enslaved us. We broke free of that slavery, and now they're still there, working behind the scenes of humanity. Either way, I say we're kind of screwed because somebody else is in control of our destiny. We have no control over either one. If it's an omniscient, all-knowing God, or if it's a superior alien race that's hanging in the wings somewhere. And so somewhere along the way, psychologically, as a race in general, we have got this unknown quantity out there that we let control and govern the way we do things. And that leads to people, you know, in any one, either one of those camps or any number of camps in between all of those things. And saying, you know, I'm looking for the benevolent alien to come and rescue us, to we have to be prepared because the reptilian race that was subjugated by the terrestrial reptilians eons ago are still here and they still want to take over. And it's all encoded in biblical prophecy. It's all and it gets so muddled and so controverted that there is no clear-cut answer to any of it. And you almost have to pick and choose. Where am I going to believe? And it really does. It comes down to that, sad to say. It comes down to not just having facts. It comes down to believing something. What do I believe is going to happen? And if you don't take a stance on a belief, you're either criticized for being wishy-washy because you don't want to take a stance, or you are, heralded as being a great open-minded thinker, when neither of them really fits the bill or answers the question. So while we're talking kind of all around the topic right now, these are all the things you've got to bring in. This all goes into the big stew pot of trying to figure out what's really real here. And again, by way of example, I could talk about the way I started viewing God as the result of writing these books. This is what my belief system was really shattered. It was already on precarious ground because I was asking lots of questions and had a lot of doubts. But then when I started looking into, I looked at the story of the reptilians. It was especially during the writing of this book where I looked into the comparisons between the Genesis story of the Garden of Eden and everything that happened thereafter and the Sumerian or Mesopotamian accounts in the cuneiform tablets of the Sumerian culture, the Akkadian culture, and how their gods ended up being the same gods we had in Judeo-Christianity. In 45 to 4800 BC, you had the Anunnaki, that pantheon of gods, and their chief gods were Elil or Enlil, and then Enki, who Elil asked to create primeval men for us, that they may do our work for us and dig our canals and mine our resources and till our ground. This is what Elil asked Enki to do, and so Enki did this. Enki is also known in the neighboring Akkadian culture as Ea, so there's Elil. Enlil is the chief god. Enki Ea is his brother god or subordinate god. And so in that culture, those cuneiform tablets dating back to 4500, 4800 BCE, you find over the next 1500 to 2000 years, those stories migrate as people migrated from the Fertile Crescent area up in the Euphrates and Tigris River valleys and down into the Canaanite culture in what is now Israel and that region. They brought those stories with them. And the Canaanites, Elil became El, was the name for God, from Elil. Same name. Elil became in the Hebrew culture Elohim, El Shaddai, El Elyon, El Elyon. And the name Enki or Ea became the base word for Yahweh, which is Jehovah in the Hebrew culture. And so these gods' names came down. Then the story of the Garden of Eden with the serpent character. And you'll find that serpent character was never called Satan, Lucifer, the devil in those original passages. It's 1,000 years later than those names were ascribed to the snake in the garden. But the character in the garden was just that, a serpent character. And he was called in the Hebrew tongue, he was called Nakosh. And Nakosh simply means the bright shining one, the illuminator, the bringer of knowledge, the trickster, the bringer of chaos. And that chaos being a chaos that it wasn't meant to be as a super negative word, it meant the bringer of chaos, the one that turns things upside down by presenting knowledge, presenting illumination. So the big question is, when you start looking at that story, you've got Elil and Enki Ea that come down and they're now Elohim and Jehovah in the Hebrew culture. You've got the serpent that comes into the Garden of Eden story, known as Nakosh, the bright shining one. And you've got back into the Sumerian culture's stories, out of the cuneiform text, you've got Enki Ea, who rose up out of the great underground sea, the Abzu, and into the serpent's marsh, the marshy wetlands around the city of Eridu in the Euphrates River culture, which is now the Iraq and Iran region. And he rose up out of the serpent's den to aid the human king Atrahasis, who pled to him for their freedom from the gods, because they were enslaved to the gods. And so Enki Ea comes up into the serpent's marsh, which became known as, because of his name, Ea's den, or eventually was watered down to Iazden, became Iaden or Eden. And that story appears in the Genesis account. And so that whole story, to me, is a retelling of the ancient Sumerian culture. Now the train comes. So bear with that. You don't even have to edit out the train, man.
No, we like trains. I ride the trains all the time. Trains are good.
Ambiance. We live in a small town in Wisconsin, and we've got a train track a block away from here. And several points throughout the day, a train likes to come by. The one at 4:30 in the morning is the best, however.
Oh, I think you should show your train some love, actually, in America, because I think you've allowed your train system to fall into neglect.
It has. I think that there's a revival amongst the trains in the whole train system here, but it was for many years it was just let go. So,
but with reference to what you were just saying, I would refer listeners to a show that I did not that long ago with a lady called Chris Hardy, and her book DNA of the Gods was doing a lot of referencing with Sumerian myth and how that transposes onto the Bible stories.
Yes.
And a couple of really interesting things come out there. One is, you know, with big implications. One is that the concept of God was actually sort of, you know, the reference to God, multiple gods. And if you take Elohim, you know, as, you know, multiple gods, then that has huge implications. But there's also the concept of original sin and the sort of sinfulness surrounding sexuality, which derives from a profound misreading of the Garden of Eden story. And if you take those two things together, that really changes a lot about everything about our existence, because so much of our culture and our ideas about, you know, life, the universe, and everything derive from the concept of there being one God and of original sin.
Well, right. And the interesting thing that I found in the biblical story of creation is that it compares to so many other cultures' stories of the first family, of the first created family. The facts all seem to kind of look alike. While there are different names, different characters, different events, they all have similarities to them. And something I noticed about Nakash, let's get back to him for a second, the serpent character in the garden, the illuminator, the illuminated one, the bright shining one, he was called, the bringer of knowledge, the trickster, the bringer of chaos. It's interesting. When you go to the preface to the Noah and the Ark story, Genesis 6, it talks about how the sons of God, the Bnei HaElohim, came down and intermingled with the daughters of men and had children by them. And that the whole story of Noah being chosen was not just because he was righteous and upheld what he believed were the precepts of God, but he was also a man who, the scripture quotes, was pure in all his generations back to Adam. Now, it's interesting, if you go further up in the Bible to the book of Psalms, you go to Psalm 82, and of course this is all within Israelite or Hebrew religion, Judaism. In Psalm 82, it has God, the singular God, speaking to a group that he himself in that passage refers to as gods. And in the language, the words are both Elohim. Elohim is one of those Hebrew words that could be used as a singular and as a plural. A singular sense in El was the name of God. Him is the Hebrew connotation, or I'm sorry, a suffix placed on a word that connotes plurality. And so it's been interpreted that God in his singular form, Elohim, appears with a multitude of majesty, and that's why it's pluralized. But then he speaks of other gods and calls them Elohim as well, meaning a plurality of gods. And so you have in this passage in Psalm 82, the name for God used the most in the Old Testament, Elohim. It literally reads this in Psalm 82. It says, and Elohim stood, singular person, singular act, in the midst of the Elohim, plural. And he, singular, said to them, plural, you are all Elohim, the bright shining princes of heaven. And then he goes to cast some judgment on them all for some deed which is unnamed in the psalm. Now you take that definition of Elohim there, the bright shining ones, the bright princes of heaven, and you go back to, all the way back to the Garden of Eden story, Nakash, the bright shining one, the bringer of knowledge and so on. He was one, I believe, of these Elohim. And what I believe happened in that story, the Genesis story, and this is carried out by the facts that follow it, and you can parse this all down, and it's right there in Scripture. I believe the sin in Eden was not Eve eating a forbidden fruit from a forbidden tree and then giving it to Adam that was tempted by the serpent character. I believe that's a cover story and an analogy it's an encoded story, because all the language there seems to indicate that there was sexual relation. And you brought up the sexual sin issue a little bit ago. It's funny how everything with the fall of man had to do, and everything thereafter, was nakedness, sexuality, the proliferation of sexual prohibitions, and so on. And the importance of the firstborn and the passing of the line down. The importance of the Messiah, who was first prophesied in the Genesis 3 account of God passing judgment on the serpent and the man and the woman for the deeds they had committed. He talks about, and there will be constant enmity or conflict between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the humans. And so there's this dual seed. I believe what happened, and it's just very indicative, you have to dig into this yourself, let's just give highlight it here, is that the sin that took place there was the giving of forbidden knowledge, as well as a sexual act between Nakosh and Eve. And Eve brings that sexual act to Adam, and they bequeath their first children, twins, Cain and Abel. And the twin factor, the multiple birth factor, is very common throughout all recorded first family stories in religious cultures. And so what you've got there is a picture of Eve having been impregnated by Nakosh, and then going to Adam and saying, look at this great thing I was just taught, and gives it to Adam, and she bequeaths with Adam as well, and they have twin sons, which, by the way, is very common. I had twins myself, my wife did, 22 years ago, and those twin daughters, we were told, were conceived at least 10 days apart. And so you have Eve bearing two children. One was fathered by Nakosh, who I believe was one of the Elohim, who I believe Cain, then, being the firstborn of his, is the first of the Nephilim. And then you have Abel, who was born of Adam and Eve. And what does Cain do? Cain murders Abel. There's all kinds of things that are not said in those passages, but you see that God is constantly speaking to Cain in those passages, comes to Cain and warns him not to sin, comes to Cain after he murders his brother and says, where's your brother? And the famous question, am I my brother's keeper? And God passes judgment on him. And Cain says, what if other people will find me? Well, according to what I see in Scripture, there were only four people. Oops, chicken scratch through Abel. There's only three people on the planet. And the Bible, the scriptural account, doesn't enumerate any more. As a matter of fact, it says Eve and Adam had sex again, and she bears a third child, Seth, her third son. And she says, God has given me a son to replace my lost son, Abel. But then everything that takes place after that, there is a prophecy that all rabbinic scholars and all Christian scholars hail to as the first messianic prophecy, the prophecy of a coming Messiah, a Christ in the Greek. And that is what he utters to the serpent in the Garden of Eden, when he passes judgment on him. He says, and there will be a day when he will come and bite, you will bite his heel, but he will crush your head. It's speaking of the coming Messiah. The Messiah became known in Hebrew culture as the kinsman redeemer, the one who would be one of us redeemer. And so all through then, after that, you see all of these different chronologies of the Hebrew people all going up to Noah, then Noah. Well, they actually do it backwards. You've got Mary, the mother of Jesus in the New Testament, that takes her lineage all the way back to King David to show that the Messiah was supposed to come from the loins of the Davidic monarchy, which was added on to the prophecies of the Messiah after the time of David. Then from David, they trace him back to Noah. And then from Noah, they trace him all the way back to Adam through not the firstborn Cain, but through the thirdborn Seth. Now, I asked everywhere else in all those chronologies, it shows the firstborn bore this son, then his firstborn bore this, his firstborn, and so on, to show that there was a messianic line for the coming Messiah that was pure-blooded, that went back to Adam. But when they got to Cain, they didn't use Cain. They used the third-born, Seth. Why? And I believe it's because Cain was not of pure human blood. He was of the blood of Nakash and Eve. And so you've got set up all through the Old Testament, the story of the Messiah is actually piggybacking the story of a dual bloodline in humanity. You've got the bloodline of Nakash. You've got the bloodline of Adam. And these two are in competition with each other. And for as many times as they say, look at this and see that the whole bloodline chronology of Adam always talks about the Messiah being the pure one, the one who is one of us, the one who is of the pure human bloodline. They say that they're obviating the opposite. If you keep saying that there was a pure bloodline, there has to be an impure bloodline. And that was the line of Cain, which was supposedly wiped out at the time of the flood, which was the purpose of the flood. So all of this creates a much bigger story. When you're talking about the reptilians, it all comes from this whole idea that Enki Ea rose up out of the serpent's marsh and brought the forbidden knowledge of the gods to Atrahasis, the human king, so he could rebel against Enlil, or Elil, the chief god, and win their freedom. And then in the story of Genesis, you have the serpent character that brings the forbidden knowledge, and they rebel against God. And there's a whole different take, a whole different twist on the story in the Hebrew culture. So you look at this story, and you see a story of race interrupted. You see a story where the serpent is a common theme. And I think this is where people start to extrapolate out of religious tales the whole reptilian presence. And this is what I saw anyway while I was researching all this. And it's so big. It's such a huge story. You can tell just by this conversation. You can't even encapsulate it. Now, you could write it in a paragraph, but nobody's going to get any information out of it.
Now, this idea of there being a eternal conflict between these sort of different bloodlines, you know, human and kind of serpent offspring, this kind of really resonates right through to today with the idea of, you know, a lot of conspiracy theorists get into this idea of there being an elite that are somehow just not like the rest of us. And right. I see this in, without getting conspiratorial about it, I see this as a very real thing in that I look sometimes on nightly news, on television, I see so-called elites, world leaders, and they almost appear to be like a different species. Whether these people are exhibiting sociopathic or even psychopathic behavior, they just don't seem to be guys that you just, you know, do, you know, shoots and pool and have a beer with. They appear to be fundamentally different. And that maps over into some of these ideas about, you know, differing bloodlines.
Right. Now, I've looked at that and I've asked myself some of the same questions. Are these differing? Is there something very different on a genetic level, on a mental level? Are these people that are perhaps it's just an IQ factor, perhaps it's an intelligence level that's different, perception level? You can see that down to even local communities and the way people operate with each other. Even in churches, church government, you see different modes of operation, different modes of thought and seeing things and understanding things. For the most part, and I don't mean this to sound offensive or weird in any way, but for the most part, people seem to be followers. They will follow somebody who presents them a good idea. And only in recent days have you seen a lot of people start to question what they've been taught, and to really move away from that. Not that that's never happened before, but I'm talking in a generalized sense. You see a lot more discarding of ancient religion and a lot more people saying, wait, there's got to be more. There's something more. I think there's a bit of an awakening there. And I don't speak that way from a, you know, a woo guru consciousness type of approach. I talk about, I think that these are things that we as human beings are starting to awaken on a different level. There are parts of our brains or our minds that are starting to see things. It was interesting. I had a conversation with Whitley Strieber a couple of years ago. If you remember him, Whitley Strieber was the man who wrote the book Communion and the books following it. about his alien experiences and things like that. And when we were talking, I said to him, I said, you know, Whitley, I said, do you know you're a crackpot? And he kind of stopped and chuckled a bit. And I said, I mean that in a polite way. I said, you have seen something that other people haven't seen, but you're the only one who's seen it. And you put it forward and you know, to you, you know that that is truth. And off of that conversation, that point, he said, you know, I believe as a human race, we are not being enlightened. He said, I believe we're remembering. He said, I believe that there were things about our past that were wiped out of our consciousness deliberately. Now, of course, that opens up the whole can of worms for a whole nother alien conspiracy theory or some higher power conspiracy. But there's the question. Are we becoming more knowledgeable? Are our minds opening up to the fact that maybe the things that we're taught, I mean, just look at a couple hundred years ago, even as late as that, the way we would respond to preaching and hellfire, everything was about God, everything was about, and so on, and different cultures and so on. But people are more so becoming much more, maybe if you will say, secularized, in that they are moving away from a religious thought and saying, wait, there's got to be something a little bit more here to this. And I'm not talking atheism, I'm not even talking agnosticism. I'm just talking a moving away from the things that we thought were once true on a faith basis to say there must be more. And I think that might be part of the answer to your question there. It's the same questions I ask.
Well, I think the idea of remembering, again, it's a bit like when I was talking to you earlier about reading those von Daniken books. It was something just inside me that was beyond the intellect that was kind of tugged at, you know. And when you talk about remembering, the same emotions, the same feelings yes. come up. And, I mean, we can reflect on the fact that the ideas of ET intervention, stories about creation, thinking back to all sorts of indigenous societies. Now, you know, the idea of the flood, the deluge, the fall right. of man, the end times, these are common themes and threads that just seem to run throughout a great deal of things, a great deal of
I agree.
Stories about our past. And again, why is that? Is there absolutely nothing to it whatsoever? I mean, I'm caused again to reflect on the idea of the Bible itself. Whether you can trace some of these stories there back to earlier times, like I said earlier with, you know, Sumeria, we yeah. have no reason to assume, like a lot of people do, that everything, that every event, every person, every idea in the Bible is all just meaningless and has no basis in reality. Why would we assume that? You know, because also the meaning of the word myth in itself has changed over time. It didn't used to mean something that was inherently untrue.
Right, right. When I talk about a biblical mythos, I'm not saying it's not true. I'm saying there is a grouping of stories and teachings, legends that become the religious mythology of even Judeo-Christianity has religious mythology. And because there are some things you can look at and say there's historical efficaciousness to this or efficacy to this, but there are other things that are the stories that you say, it's going to take a lot of faith to believe that that happened that way, that a donkey talked to a man or that waters parted of the Great Sea and so on and things like that. You know, what is a glorified story versus what is... what is a story that has been built into mythology? It's become so legendary that it's become a myth. And those are the big questions we have to ask about any of this stuff.
I think we may find, you know, in future, well, we won't, but our descendants will, that maybe the manned space flight, the space shuttle, the internet,
yeah.
the United States of America could all become things that people thought, well, yeah, well, that didn't exist. It's just
right.
a myth.
Right, exactly. So, and again, this isn't digging into that. There are other authors and other pundits who put forward all the DNA stuff and all the stuff about reptilians and all of that. As for me, I take a very different tack on that. I want to remove myself from examining those things and look at the, in a sense, an overall, the nutshell of it. Does this look like mythology? What does it look like? Is it ancient mythology? Is it real? Or is it, so I want to look at why we believe what we believe. I want to look at if there is evidence, what is that evidence really telling us? And is it even really solid evidence that we're going on? Or is it what we, an evidence that we have, morphed into being the truth that backs our theory. And that's the very hard part of it all. We were just talking on Sunday night about the end times, not from a biblical standpoint, but I did have a biblical a man who's a very entrenched. Oh, L.A. Marzulli came on and spoke with us on our radio show on Sunday night, and we talked about all of this. And yet, he is somebody, as much as I love and respect L.A. Marzulli, he's somebody that answers the questions about this from within the faith, as rather from without. And so when he talked about prophecy that's been fulfilled, he talked about Christ and how in a 24-hour period, all these prophecies about the coming Messiah were all fulfilled by Christ, to the no breaking of bones, to the piercing his hands and his feet and things like that. But all of that stuff is stuff you have to ask yourself a question from an anthropological point of view. Did that actually happen that way, or was that what was written after the fact? Because there are other religions that say other things. And again, I'm not at all discounting that Jesus himself may have been the Son of God. I believe that for a long time. But you got to ask yourself the question. Who wrote it? Why did they write it? When was it written? Was there prophecy fulfilled, or was there prophecies given that his followers made sure that they were fulfilled in their future writings, which were all written not less than 30 to 40 years after his death? So the big question is, and I only use that by way of example, all of this stuff, how much are we extrapolating information to make it fit as opposed to saying, let's step back and look at the facts? It's like that great old sage, Indiana Jones. He once said, if you watch the first movie, he's scrawling on his chalkboard and he says, tells his class, he says, archaeology is the pursuit of fact, not the pursuit of truth. He said, if you want truth, go down to so-and-so's philosophy class down the hall. He says, this is the pursuit of fact. And so what we so many times get caught up in is the pursuit of truth. What is truth and what should we believe, as opposed to what are the facts? And that's where we have to be the small s skeptic and say, I believe there's a lot more to this, but I want to know what the facts are first so I know what I'm talking about. And that's what we have to look into. And we have to look into how these stories came into existence, how these stories proliferated over the centuries and millennia. We've got to look at what's behind them, what's to them, how much are they similar to other cultures, what was borrowed from other cultures. It's like I said, I used the example of Islam. I said Muhammad, who was an aristocrat, who had as mentors of his, he had a Christian who was a good friend and a mentor. He had a Jewish man who was a good friend and a mentor. Yes, Muhammad had a Jew for a good friend of his and a mentor. They both told him, if you want to unify your splintered Arabic clans, you need to go monotheistic. And so he went to Mecca, where there were over 290 different gods that they worshipped in Mecca. He eliminated all but one of them, and subordinated them as angelic or spirit beings or something, but he raised Hamal to and renamed him Allah. He says, now Allah is the one true God, the one true monotheistic God. So in a sense, what Muhammad did is what Moses did. He created a monotheistic system for the purpose of nationalizing his people, rallying his people and unifying them under one God. And this is the kind of thing that happens all through the course of these religious stories, these conspiracy theories. Believe it or not, and folks, you got to admit it, ancient alien theory is as religious as biblical theory, because it's just supplanting one object of faith for another, because we don't have proof for any of it. The only proof we have is like, you know, religion. It's in my heart. It's in my mind. What proof do we have that there's a reptilian race? Well, my second step cousin, you know, red haired Darlene, had an experience where a reptilian man would come to her every Tuesday night and have sex with her in her bedroom at midnight. That proves to me that there's an alien race, and she's very credible. She would never lie about this kind of thing. Those are the kinds of stories we hear that are evidences for these things. We have no evidence that there was a reptilian race at all, other than when you step way back outside of the box and look at all these different religious cultures. They all had reptilian presences in them. They all have reptilian gods, reptilian idols. Look at even Moses. The word Nakosh, I said, for the serpent in the garden. Remember after the Exodus when the children of Israel are wandering for 40 years in the wilderness and they're falling away from God. They're not doing what God wants them to do. And so he sends serpents to bite them all and to kill them. And then God says, but I'm sending all these serpents to kill everybody for making me pissed off. But here's the way they can all have salvation. Make a bronze serpent, elevate it on a pole, and whoever looks to the serpent will be healed. So God, who brought the judgment, also brought the way of escape. But it was in the form of the brazen serpent. And the name for the brazen serpent was the Nakoshta. It was off of the serpent from the Garden of Eden. It was the same word, the brazen, bright, shining serpent. And so all of these stories, they start to get all mixed in together and convoluted. And who's got the right story? Who's got the truth? Who's got the corner on the facts? We don't know. All we have to go on is mythology. And that's where I say the whole issue of the reptilian race is mythological. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It means in the form it's in, without any proof, it's legend and mythology. And carried all the way from, you know, pre-Mosaic times, you know, the creation times, all the way through, you know, the time of Christ. It came up into the Merovingians in the 400s to the 700s AD. It went from there into all different occultist worships. It went into, I saw it, Blavatsky.
Theosophists.
The Theosophists. There you go. Had a mental block there. Theosophists. Out of the Theosophists, who took that? German revisionists took that and built that up. And a couple of German revisionists started the Thule Society. And who came out of the Thule Society? Adolf Hitler. And he took some of those same ideas. He was very occultic and took those into Nazism. And so you can see the progression of how things started one way and turned into something else. And there's an evolution to all of that. But the big question is, what's true? We don't know for sure because there's no real proof.
Just to take a two-minute sort of detour, there's a small number of people who keep reptiles as pets. But generally, it's not widespread. And, I mean, I haven't seen – we don't have many.
I had one.
We don't have many – oh, really?
Yeah, we had a little hooded dragon.
Okay, well, maybe you can – this will be, obviously, you'll be able to opine on this, but we don't have many snakes or reptiles here in the UK.
Well, that's because St. Patrick got rid of them all.
Well, I come from Ireland, and apparently there's none whatsoever. I've never seen any. But I haven't seen a snake in 20 years. But the last time I remember, it was on a picnic and walking through some long grass. A very small black adder appeared. But I recoiled from the thing. I knew it wasn't venomous. It was no threat whatsoever. It was probably terrified of me, but I still recoiled from it. And I wondered, is our sort of what appears to be a sort of instinctive revulsion around reptiles, does it have any meaning? Is it any different to the way that most of us don't care for insects? I don't know if there's anything to it.
You know, there's that collective fear of reptilians, and then there's that collective worship of reptilians, which I see as this great paradox in history, is that while the reptilian took on a very fearsome form, at the same time, it was very honored and respected in some cultures. Even in the same culture, Egyptian culture had the serpents that were to be feared and the serpent gods that were to be honored. Look at the Chinese culture. The Chinese dragon is really an extrapolation of the reptilian, but the Chinese dragon was a godly or divine presence of happiness, joy, fertility. So you see all different kinds of reptilian characters throughout religious history and how they had different connotations. So it's a very feared, yet very respected, yet very honored. When I had a lizard for a pet, a hooded dragon, is that really a snake? No. Is it a reptilian? Yeah, it's in the reptilian genus, I believe. But it's a or is that amphibian? I don't know. Reptilian. In any case, and we didn't fear him. We feared getting nipped if we put our finger in there, and he might think it's a piece of meat, but he would crawl up on your arm, he'd sit on your shoulder and fall asleep. And they were very cognitive of who we were. And there is, in history, all throughout history, the mutual respect and fear of the serpentine or the reptilian.
Well, we spoke earlier about this sort of human, this innate human need to contemplate, to try and reach towards, you know, life, the universe and everything, why we're here, where we come from, where we're going. And you've got a nice quote towards the end of the book from, I'm not sure how I pronounce his name, the physicist, is it Richard Feynman?
Feynman.
Feynman, okay. And he talks about the fact that, you know, he's comfortable with not knowing. And it's it's better to not know than just to believe. And that, as a race, you know, as a species, we seem somewhat uncomfortable with not knowing. And we settle for all sorts of bullshit in order that we can sleep at night by thinking that we know something.
Yeah. Oh, well, in a sense, we coddle ourselves. And that's I even looked into that in the book on the reptilians. I looked into the fathers of modern psychotherapy, you know, Freud and Adler, and there are two different approaches to things. And, you know, one is saying you've got to look into your past and dig into your past to find out your purpose. And the other is saying your purpose really lies in what you, the road you lay for your future and the view that you have. And, so I think we tend to, as human beings, want to find that comfortable niche that fits for us. And we get comfortable with it, and then we go into dormant mode because, oh, I found it. I've discovered that's where, and yeah, it's God, or it's this, or it's that, or the other thing. And I'm comfortable with that, and we coddle ourselves to say, and I am now safe from hellfire, or I am safe from destruction. I am safe from everything in the world because I know God has his control on it. And I'm only using that as an I'm not against God at all. I'm just saying that's what we do with God. God becomes our lucky rabbit's foot. You know, we get in trouble. What do? We pull out God and rub the rabbit's foot. And when we do that, all we are doing is we are, in essence, dismissing ourselves from the responsibility of having to find out any answers because it's all been found for me. So, yeah, that's what this is really all about for me. This research is saying I want to know something. I don't want to be told. I want to know. And I think we can know, or at least we can start striving toward that end.
Another little random detour here, just for a second, because I didn't know where else to shoehorn this question into the talk, was have you come across any of the theories about intelligent dinosaurs? I recently read a book by a chap called Mike McGee, an Englishman, and he wrote a book called Who Lies Sleeping? And he goes into a great deal of fascinating speculation about the idea that the dinosaurs did in fact develop intelligence, certainly on a par with that which we ascribe to ourselves before their extinction, and in fact that they made themselves extinct. I just don't know if that's something you've stumbled across in your research.
You know, I've stumbled across those theories and I haven't looked much into it. You know, for me, I say rather tongue in cheek, you know, I don't know if there's any evidence of a dinosaur wearing a cravat and toting an umbrella. I don't know how advanced dinosaurs actually got. Did they I know that there are some theories out there that saying that, you know, the pack mentality or the herd hunting mentality, the herd as they found them. Those are things that they speculate on. They don't know for sure because they aren't here to study. All we have is bones and footprints and things like that. So I've run across that. I don't know what to do with that other than to put it into that category of it's speculative research. We have no idea. We have no way to test that theory. And that's the problem.
Oh, well, thank you for indulging me anyway.
Sure.
In your time in religious circles, in private conversations, did you find any clergymen, priests, whatever denomination, willing to admit to doubts, basically that some of the questions that you had were actually valid?
That's interesting. I did have a Byzantine priest who was a friend of mine that endorsed the reptilian book as well as the Nephilim book, but officially for reptilians. And he actually wrote the foreword for John Ward's in my book, The Exodus Reality, after that, but has since come back and denounced us both as heretic occultists and all of that kind of stuff. Because he disagrees with me on my theory of the serpent seed theology that's taught in the church as a heretical theology. That's talking about how the serpent impregnated Eve and so on. There was a dual bloodline. He's denounced me as a racist and all of this because I said Noah was pure-blooded human, and so have others. So the church has come across, not the church officially, individual practitioners, shall we say. A Byzantine priest came out and denounced us after writing a glowing testimonial on the book. And I mean, it was very glowing. And he said, every Christian ought to read this book because of this, 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 and this. And he's very enunciates his reasons for saying so. And then has come out and denounced the book since then, because he now disagrees with that theory. And so you're going to get religious mindset. Something I found is with this pair of books, The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim and The Secret History of the Reptilians, I drew enough fire from, I got criticism as well as praise from the scientific community, the skeptical community, the religious community, the Jewish community, the Christian community, and readers at large. It's kind of equal, 50-50 split down the middle for the criticism versus praise. So everybody is going to approach these things from their particular bias or mindset. And that's the problem from the get-go, is when you approach from those biases, you don't have an open mind to look for fact.
If we could just say a word about the reptilian thesis, scenario, theories with regards to kind of current sort of popular culture and the zeitgeist of our times. I mean, I have met, you speak about conspiracy theories and conspiracy theorists towards the end of the book. You've got a whole section on it. And I've met David Icke several times. I've spoken with him. And in my opinion, that guy is not crazy. Whatever he believes or doesn't believe, whatever, that's, you know, that's a matter for him. And whatever you want to, you know, if you can buy into it or not. But there does seem to be something, again, as I spoke earlier, about the information that he presents and others that seems to, you know, to fire something in people. It seems to be a light bulb moment, and whether it's actually accurate or not is kind of neither here nor there, but it seems to speak to a sort of a need. It seems to offer the promise of plugging a gap that's there, that's very meaningful.
Well, I, you know, David Icke, he's somebody that I criticized heavily in my book, and yet I left this one caveat. I said it doesn't mean he's not onto something. It means and I've never pronounced him crazy. I just said I disagree with him, and I said I think he's got a stance on things that is actually very off the mark, and a little too extreme for my liking. Now, just because he's extreme doesn't mean he's wrong. No, it means that I think he's extreme and he relies too much on the spiritual consciousness gathering stuff as opposed to solid fact. He's a guy I would love to interview someday. I'd love to talk to him, find out what he's really like. I don't think he's crazy. I think he's got some crazy ideas, but I don't think he's insane by any means. But I do take him to task a little bit in my book without him being present.
Okay, Scott, today we have been talking about your book, The Secret History of the Reptilians, and we could go on and on for hours. It's relentlessly fascinating. But before we sign off, the book is widely available, as are your other ones. But tell folks about your website. You mentioned you do a radio show. Just anything else you'd like to share with listeners before we end for today?
Sure. Well, I've got a ton of stuff that I do that's all focused around, you know, writing the books that I write. I've got Intrepid Magazine, which I founded 3 years ago. I was the editor-in-chief of the Ghost Hunters from the Sci-Fi Network, their official magazine, Taps Paramag, and I left that outfit and founded Intrepid Magazine. You can find it at intrepidmag.com. We talk about all this stuff, science, politics, fringe elements of both of those, metaphysics, ancient aliens, archaeology, history, fringe, and alternative theory and stuff like that. So intrepidmag.com. We every year throw a big symposium, and it's the first weekend of October this year in Minneapolis, Minnesota, here in the United States. And so if anybody wants to come over from your neck of the woods, it's October 2nd through the 5th. You can find it at paradigmsymposium.com. This is our third year. We have speakers like Eric Von Daniken is going to be here, Robert Bavall, Andrew Collins, Richard Dolan, Graham Hancock will be here, and 16 speakers in all. So it's going to be a pretty fabulous 4 days in Minneapolis. We also have our book, John and I, authored together. Dr. John Ward is my co-author My latest book, the Exodus Reality, if you want to find out a little bit more about the archaeology and the historical information behind Moses, the historical Moses, you can go to exodusreality.com. And we also take people to Egypt on a trip called the Exodus Reality Adventures. And you can find that at that same site, Exodus Reality. Don't go to Exodus Realty. You'll get to a totally different site and somebody wants to sell you Sinai Desert land or something. But exodusreality.com. And if you want to look up me personally, my full name is ScottAllenRoberts.com. Allen is A-L-A-N.
Wonderful. Well, Scott, thank you so much for spending time with us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Well, thanks for having me. I sure appreciate it.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy the show, please check out the website. That's LegalizeFreedom.com, Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including world affairs, politics and economics, science and technology, religion and spirituality, conspiracy, and alternative history. You can also browse and buy a range of books and DVDs from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.